Chapter 9. Lisi and the Black Prince of the Inkunks. The Duty of Love. 1. If Lisi didn't sound like herself, Darla didn't notice. She was too guilty. Also too happy and relieved. Canty was coming back from Boston to help out with Mandy. As if she could. As if anyone can, including Hugh Albernus and the entire Greenlawn staff, Lisi thought, listening to Darla prattle on. You can help, Scott murmured. Scott, who would always have his say. It seemed that not even death would stop him. You can, baby love. Entirely her own idea, Darla was assuring. Uh-huh, Lisi said. She could have pointed out that Canty would still be enjoying her time away with her husband, entirely unaware that Amanda had a problem if Darla hadn't felt the need to call her, hadn't stuck her oar in, as the saying was. But the last thing Lisi wanted right now was an argument. What she wanted was to put the damned cedar box back under the mind-got bed and see if she could forget she had ever found it in the first place. While talking to Darla, another of Scott's old maxims had occurred to her. The harder you had to work to open a package, the less you ended up caring about what was inside. She was sure you could adapt that to missing items, cedar boxes, for instance. Her flight gets into Portland Jetport just a little past noon, Darla was saying, all in a rush. She said she'd rent a car, and I said, no, that's silly. I said I'll come down and pick you up. Here she paused, gathering herself for the final leap. You could meet us there, Lisi, if you wanted. We could all have lunch at the Snow Squall, just us girls, like in the good old days. Then we could go up and see Amanda. Now, which good old days would those be, Lisi thought. The ones where you used to pull my hair? Or the ones when Candy used to chase me around and call me Little Lisa No Tits? What she said was, you go on down and I'll join you if I can, Darl. I've got some things here I have to... More cooking? Now that she had confessed to guilting Cantata into coming north, Darla sounded positively roguish. No, this has to do with donating Scott's old papers. And in a way, it was the truth. Because no matter how the business with Dooley McCool turned out, she wanted Scott's study emptied. No more dawdling. Let the papers go to Pitt. That was undoubtedly where they belonged. But with the stipulation that her professor pal should have nothing to do with them. Woodsmucket could go hang. Oh, Darla said, sounding suitably impressed. Well, in that case. I'll join you if I can, Lisi repeated. If not, I'll see you both this afternoon at Greenlawn. That was Jake with Darla. She passed on Canty's flight information, which Lisi obediently wrote down. Hell, she supposed she might even go down to Portland. At the very least, it would get her out of the house, away from the phone, the cedar box, and most of the memories that now seemed poised above her head like the contents of some terrible, sagging piñata. And then before she could stop it, one more fell out. She thought, you didn't just go out from under the willow into the snow, Lisi. There was a little more to it than that. He took you... No, she shouted and slapped the table. The sound of herself shouting was frightening, but it did the trick, lopped off the dangerous train of thought cleanly and completely. It might grow back, though. That was the trouble. Lisi looked at the cedar box sitting on the table. It was the look a woman might give a well-loved dog that has bitten her for no particular reason. Back under the bed with you, she thought. Back under the mind-got bed, and then what? Bull, the end. That's what, she said. Then she left the house, crossing the dooryard to the barn, holding the cedar box out before her as if it contained something either breakable or highly explosive. 2. Her office door stood open. From its foot, a bright rectangle of electric light lay across the barn floor. The last time Lisi had been in there, she'd left laughing. What she didn't remember was if she'd left the door open or shut. She thought the light had been off, thought she'd never turned it on in the first place. On the other hand, at one point she'd been absolutely positive that Goodma's cedar box had been in the attic, hadn't she? Was it possible one of the deputies had gone in there for a peek and left the light on? Lisi supposed it was. She supposed anything was possible. Clutching the cedar box to her middle almost protectively, she went to the open office door and looked in. It was empty, appeared to be empty. But without the least self-consciousness, She applied one eye to the crack between the jamb and the door. Zack McCool wasn't standing back there. No one was. But when she looked into the office again, she could see that the answering machine's message window was once more lit up with a bright red one. She went in, tucked the box under one arm, and pushed the play button. There was a moment of silence, and then Jim Dooley's calm voice spoke. "Missus, I thought we agreed on 8 o'clock last night," he said. "Now I see cops around the place. Seems like you don't understand how serious this business is. Though I should think a dead cat in a mailbox would be pretty hard to misunderstand." A pause. She looked down at the answering machine, fascinated. "I can hear him breathing," she thought. "I'll be seeing you, missus," he said. "Smuck you," she whispered. "Now, missus, that isn't nice," said Jim Dooley, and for a moment she thought the answering machine had, well, answered her. Then she realized the second version of Dooley's voice was in living color, so to speak, and had come from behind her. Once again feeling like an inhabitant in one of her own dreams, Lisey Landon turned around to face him. 3. She was dismayed by his ordinariness. Even standing in the doorway of her little never-was barn office with a gun in one hand, he had what looked like a lunch sack in the other. She wasn't sure she could have picked him out of a police lineup, assuming the other men in it were also slim, dressed in summer weight khaki work clothes, and wearing Portland Sea Dogs baseball caps. His face was narrow and unlined, the eyes bright blue, the face of a million Yankees, in other words, not to mention 6 or 7 million hillbilly men from the mid and deep south. He might have been 6 feet tall, he might have been a little under. The lick of hair which escaped the ball cap's round rim was an unremarkable sandy brown. Lisey looked into the black eye of the pistol he held and felt the strength run out of her legs. This was no cheap hawkshot 22. This was the real deal, a big automatic. She thought it was an automatic that would make a big hole. She sat down on the edge of her desk. If the desk hadn't been there, she was pretty sure she would have gone sprawling on the floor. For a moment, she was almost positive she was going to wet her pants, but she managed to hold her water, for the time being, at least. "Take what you want," she whispered through lips that felt Novocaine numb. "Take all of it."
"Come upstairs, missus," he said. "We'll talk about it upstairs."
The idea of being in Scott's study with this man filled her with horror and revulsion. "No, just take his papers and go. Leave me alone." He stared at her patiently. At first glance, he looked 35. Then you saw the little fans of wrinkles at the corners of his eyes and mouth, and realized he was 5 more than that, 5 at least.
"Upstairs, missus, unless you want to start this with a bullet in the foot. That'd be a painful way to talk business. There's a lot of bones and tendons in a person's foot."
"You won't. You don't dare. The noise."
Her voice sounded farther away with each word. It was as if her voice were on a train and the train was pulling out of the station. Her voice was leaning out of its window to bid her a fond farewell. "Bye-bye, little Lacey. Voice must leave you now. Soon you'll be mute."
"Oh, the noise wouldn't fuss me a bit," Dooley said, looking amused. "Your next-door neighbors are gone. Off to work, I imagine. And your pet cop's off on a run."
His smile faded, yet he still managed to look amused.
"You've come all over gray. Reckon you've had quite a shock to the system. Reckon you're gonna pass clean out, missus. Save me some trouble if you do, maybe."
"Stop. Stop calling me."
Missus was how she wanted to finish, but a series of wings seemed to be enfolding her, wings of darker and darker gray. Before they grew too dark and too thick to see through, she was faintly aware of Dooley shoving the gun into the waistband of his pants. "Blow your balls off," Lisey thought dreamily. "Do the world a favor." And darting forward to catch her. She didn't know if he made it. Before the issue was decided, Lisey had fainted. 4. She became aware of something wet stroking her face and at first thought a dog was licking her. Louise, maybe. except Lou had been their collie back in Lisbon Falls, and Lisbon Falls had been a long time ago. She and Scott had never had a dog, maybe because they'd never had kids, and the two things just naturally seemed to go together like peanut butter and jelly, or peaches and cream.
Come upstairs, missus, unless you want to start this with a bullet in the foot.
That brought her back fast. She opened her eyes and saw Dooley squatting before her with a damp washcloth in one hand, watching her, those bright blue eyes. She tried to pull away from them. There was a metallic rattle, then a dull thud of pain in her shoulder as something snubbed tight and stopped her.
Ow! Don't yank and you won't hurt yourself, Dooley said,
as though this were the most reasonable thing in the world. Lisa supposed that to a nut job like him, it probably was. There was music playing through Scott's sound system for the first time in Christ knew how long, maybe since April or May of 2004, the last time he was in here, writing. Waymore's Blues. Not old Hank, but someone's cover version. The Crickets, maybe. Not super loud, not cranked the way Scott used to crank the music, but loud enough. She had a very good idea.
I am going to hurt you.
Of why Mr. Jim, Zach McCool, Dooley, had turned on the sound system. She didn't...
Places you didn't let the boys to touch.
Want to think about that. What she wanted was to be unconscious again, actually. But she couldn't seem to help it. The mind is a monkey, Scott used to say, and Lisi remembered the source of that one even now, sitting on the floor in the bar alcove with one wrist apparently handcuffed to a water pipe under the sink. Dog Soldiers by Robert Stone. Go to the head of the class, little Lisi. If, that is, you can ever go anywhere ever again.
Ain't that just the cutest song? Dooley said, sitting down in the alcove doorway.
He crossed his legs tailor fashion. His brown paper lunch sack was in the diamond-shaped hole thus formed by them. The pistol lay on the floor beside his right hand. Dooley looked at her sincerely.
A lot of truth in it, too. You did yourself a favor, you know, passing out the way you did. I tell you what.
Now she could hear the South in his voice, not all showy like the chicken shit asshole from Nashville, but just a fact of life.
Favor, tell you what.
From his sack, he took a quart mayonnaise jar with the Hellman's label still on it. Inside, floating in a puddle of clear liquid, was a crumpled white rag.
Chloroform, he said,
sounding as proud as Smiley Flanders had been of his moose.
I was told how to use it by a fella, claimed to know, but he also said it was easy to do things wrong. At the very best, you would have woken up with a bad headache, missus. But I knew you wouldn't want to come up here. I had a twitching about that.
He cocked a finger at her like a gun, smiling as he did so, and on the sound system, Dwight Yoakam began to sing A Thousand Miles from Nowhere. Dooley must have found one of Scott's homemade honky-tonk CDs. May I have a drink of water, Mr. Dooley?
Huh? Oh, sure. Mouth a little dry, is it? A person has a shock to the system, that's gonna happen every time.
He got up, leaving the gun where it was, probably out of her reach, even if she lunged to the limit of the handcuff chain. And to try for it and come up short would be a bad idea indeed. He turned on the tap. The pipes chugged and glugged. After a moment or two, she heard the faucet begin to spit water. Yes, the gun was probably out of reach, but Dooley's crotch was almost directly over her head, no more than a foot away, and she had one hand free. As if reading her mind, Dooley said,
"You could ring my chimes a damn good'un, if you wanted, I guess. But these are Doc Martens I'm wearing on my feet, and you're not wearing anything tall on your hands."
From Dooley, at all, came out one word, tall.
Be smart, missus, and settle for a nice, cool drink. This tap ain't been run much for a while, but it's clearing out a right smart.
Rinse the glass before you fill it, she said. Her voice sounded hoarse, on the verge of breaking. They haven't been used much either.
Roger Wilco.
Just as pleasant as could be. Reminded her of anyone from town. Reminded her of her own dad, for that matter. Of course, Dooley also reminded her of Gerd Allen Cole, the original 5150 kid. For a moment, she almost reached up and twisted his balls anyway, just for daring to put her in this position. For a moment, she could barely restrain herself. Then Dooley was bending down, holding out one of the heavy Waterford glasses. It was 3/4 full, and while the water hadn't run entirely clear, it looked clear enough to drink. It looked wonderful.
"Slow and easy does it," Dooley said in a solicitous tone. "I'll let you hold the glass, but if you throw it at me, I'm gonna have to snap your ankle. Hit me with it, and I'll snap both of them for you. Even if you don't draw blood. I mean it, all right?"
She nodded and sipped her glass of water. On the stereo, Dwight Yoakam gave way to old Hank himself, asking the eternal questions. "Why don't you love me like you used to do? How come you treat me like a worn-out shoe?" Dooley squatted on his hunkers, his butt almost touching the raised heels of his boots, one arm wrapped around his knees. He could have been a farmer watching a cow drink at a stream in the North 40. She judged he was on alert, but not on high alert. He didn't expect her to throw the clunky drinking glass, and of course he was right not to expect it. Lisey didn't want her ankles snapped. "Why, I've never even taken that all-important first in-line skating lesson," she thought. "And Tuesday nights are singles nights at Oxford Skate Central." When her thirst was slaked, she held the glass out to him. Dooley took it, examined it.
"You sure you don't want those last two swallers, missus?"
Not even close to swallers, and Lisey had a sudden tuition of her own. Dooley was exaggerating the good old boy thing. Maybe on purpose, maybe even without realizing it. When it came to language, he corrected up, because he would have been pretentious to correct down. Did it matter? Probably not. "I've had enough." Dooley polished the last two swallows off himself, his Adam's apple sliding in his skinny throat. Then he asked her if she was feeling any better.
"I'll feel better when you're gone."
"Fair enough. I won't take up much of your time."
He tucked the gun back into his waistband and got to his feet. His knees popped, and Lisey thought again, marveled, really,
"This is no dream. This is really happening to me."
He kicked the glass absently, and it rolled a little way onto the oyster-white wall-to-wall carpet out there in the main office. He hitched up his pants.
"Can't afford to linger in any case, missus. Your cop will be back, him or another. And I got an idea you got some kind of sister twister going on as well, isn't that so?"
Lisey made no reply. Dooley shrugged as if to say, "Have it your way," and then leaned out of the bar alcove. For Lisey, it was a surreal moment, because she had seen Scott do exactly the same thing many times, one hand gripping each side of the doorless doorway, feet on the bare wood of the alcove, head and torso out in the study. But Scott would never have been caught dead in khakis. He had been a blue jeans man to the end. Also, there had been no bald spot at the back of his head.
"My husband died with a full head of hair," she thought.
"Awful nice place," he said. "What is it? Converted hayloft? Must be."
She said nothing. Dooley continued to lean out, now rocking back and forth a little, looking to the left, then right. Lord of all he surveys, she thought.
"Real nice place," he said. "Just about what I would have expected. You got your 3 rooms, what I'd call rooms, and your 3 skylights, so there's plenty of natural light. Down home, we call places all a row like this shotgun houses or sometimes shotgun shacks. But ain't nothing shacky about this, is it?"
Lisey said nothing. He turned to her, looking serious.
"Not that I begrudge him, missus, or you, now that he's dead. I did some time in Brushy Mountain State Prison. Maybe the prof told you that. And it was your husband got me through the worst of it. I read all his books, and you know which one I liked best?"
"Of course," Lisey thought, "Empty Devils. You probably read it 9 times. But Dooley surprised her.
"The Coaster's Daughter. And I didn't just like it, missus. I loved it. I've made it my business to read that book every 2 or 3 years since I found it in the jailhouse library, and I could quote you whole long passages of it. You know what part I like the best? Where Jean finally talks back, tells his father he's leaving, whether the old man likes it or not. Do you know what he tells that miserable, holy, rolling old fuck? Pardon my French.
That he has never understood the duty of love, Lisi thought. But she said nothing. Dooley didn't seem to mind. He was on a roll now, enraptured.
Jean says his old man has never understood the duty of love. The duty of love. How beautiful is that? How many of us have felt something like that, but haven't never had the words to say it? But your husband did. For all of us who otherwise would have stood mute. That's what the prof said. God must have loved your man, missus, to give him such a tongue.
Dooley looked up at the ceiling. The cords on his neck stood out.
The duty of love. And the one God loves best he takes home soonest to be with him. Amen.
He lowered his head briefly. His wallet stuck out of his back pocket. It was on a chain. Of course it was. Men like Jim Dooley always wore their wallets on chains that were attached to their belt loops. Now he looked up again and said,
He deserved a nice place like this. I hope he enjoyed it, when he wasn't agonizing over his creations.
Lisi thought of Scott at the desk he called Dumbo's Big Jumbo, sitting before his big screen Mac and laughing at something he'd just written, chewing either a plastic straw or his own fingernails, sometimes singing along with the music, making arm farts if it was summer and hot and his shirt was off. That was how he agonized over his smucking creations. But she still said nothing. On the sound system, old Hank gave way to his son. Junior was singing, Whiskey Bent and Hellbound. Dooley said,
Giving me the old silent treatment? Well, more power to you, but it won't do you no good, missus. You have some correction coming. I won't try to sell you the old one about how it's gonna hurt me more than it's gonna hurt you. But I will say I've come to like your spunk in the short time I've known you, and that it's going to hurt both of us. I also want to say I'll go as easy as I can, 'cause I don't want to break that spirit of yours. Still, we had an agreement, and you didn't keep to it.
An agreement? Lisi felt a chill sweep through her body. For the first time, she got a clear picture of the breadth and complexity of Dooley's insanity. The gray wings threatened to descend across her vision, and this time, she fought them fiercely. Dooley heard the rattle of the handcuff chain. He must have had the cuffs in his sack along with the mayonnaise jar, and turned to her.
Easy, baby love, easy, Scott murmured. Talk to the guy. Run your everlasting mouth.
This was advice Lisi hardly needed. As long as the talking was going on, the correcting would remain deferred. Listen to me, Mr. Dooley. We didn't have an agreement. You're mistaken about that. She saw his brow begin to furrow, his look begin to darken, and hurried on. Sometimes it's hard to get things together over the phone, but I'm ready to work with you now. She swallowed and heard a distinct click in her throat. She was ready for more water, a good long cool drink of it, but this didn't seem like a good time to ask. She leaned forward, fixed his eyes with her own, blue on blue, and spoke with all the earnestness and sincerity she could muster. I'm saying that as far as I'm concerned, you've made your point. And you know what? You were just looking at the manuscripts your colleague especially wants. Did you notice the black file cabinets in the central space? Now he was looking at her with his eyebrows hoisted and a skeptical little smile playing on his mouth. But that might only be his dickering look. Lisi allowed herself to hope.
Looked to me like there was a right smart of boxes downstairs, too, he said. More of his books, from the look of them.
Those are... What was she going to tell him? Those are bools, not books? She guessed that most of them were, but Dooley wouldn't understand. They're practical jokes. Scott's version of itchy powder and plastic vomit? That he'd understand, but likely not believe. He was still looking at her with that skeptical smile. Not a dickering look at all. No, this was a look that said, While you're at it,
Why don't you go on and pull the other one, Mrs.?
There's nothing in those cartons downstairs but carbon copies and Xeroxes and blank sheets, she said, and it sounded like a lie because it was a lie. And what was she supposed to say? You're too crazy to understand the truth, Mr. Dooley. Instead, she rushed on. The stuff Wood Smucky wants, the good stuff, is all up here. Unpublished stories, copies of letters to other writers, their letters back to him.
Dooley threw back his head and laughed.
Wood Smucky, Mrs. You got your husband's way with words.
Then the laughter faded, and although the smile stayed on his lips, there was no more amusement in his eyes. His eyes looked like ice.
So what do you think I should do? Hie over to Oxford or Mechanic Falls and rent a U-Haul, then come back here, load those filing cabinets up? Say, maybe you could get one of those deputy boys to help me.
Shut up. Pointing a finger at her, the smile all gone now.
Why, if I was to go away and then come back, you'd have a dozen state police graybacks here waiting for me, I reckon. They'd take me in. And, Mrs., I tell you what, I deserve another 10 years inside just for believing such a thing.
But, and besides, that wasn't
the deal we made. The deal was that you'd call the prof, old Wood Smucky. Girl, I like that. And he'd send me an email the special way we have. And then he'd arrange about the papers, right?
Part of him actually believed this. Had to believe it, or why would he keep on with it when it was just the two of them?
Ma'am?
Dooley asked her. He sounded solicitous.
Mrs.?
If there was a part of him that had to go on telling lies when it was just the two of them, maybe it was because there was a part of him that needed lying too. If so, that was the part of Jim Dooley she needed to reach. The part that might still be sane. Mr. Dooley, listen to me. She pitched her voice low and kept her delivery slow. It had been the way she talked to Scott when Scott was ready to go off half-cocked over anything from a bad review to a shoddy piece of plumbing. Professor Woodbody has no way of getting in touch with you, and down inside somewhere, you know that. But I can get in touch with him. I already have. I called him last night.
You're lying, he said.
But this time she wasn't, and he knew she wasn't. And for some reason, it upset him. That reaction ran exactly counter to the one she wanted to provoke. She wanted to soothe him, but she thought she had to go on, hoping the sane part of Jim Dooley was in there somewhere, listening. I'm not, she said. You left me his number and I called him. Holding Dooley's eyes with hers, mustering every bit of sincerity she could manage as she headed back into the land of fabrication. I promised him the manuscripts and told him to call you off, and he said he couldn't call you off because he had no way of getting in touch with you anymore. He said his first two emails went through, but after that, they just bounced back.
One lies and the other swears to it,
Jim Dooley said, and after that, things happened with a speed and a ferocity Lisi could hardly credit, although every moment of the beating and mutilation that followed remained vivid in her mind for the rest of her life, right down to the sound of his dry and rapid breathing, right down to the way his khaki shirt strained at the buttons, showing little winks of the white t-shirt he wore beneath as he slapped her across her face, backhand and then forehand again. 8 blows in all. 8, 8, lay them straight, they chanted as children skip-roping in the dooryard dust, and the sound of his skin on her skin was like dry kindling snapped over a knee, and although the hand he used was ringless, there was that much to be grateful for. The 4th and 5th blows beat the blood from her lips, the 6th and 7th sent it spraying, and the last rode high enough to smash her nose and set that gushing as well. By then she was crying in fear and pain. Her head thumped repeatedly against the underside of the bar sink, making her ears ring. She heard herself crying out for him to stop, that he could have whatever he wanted if he would only stop. Then he did stop, and she heard herself saying, I can give you the manuscript of a new novel, his last novel. It's all done. He finished it a month before he died and never got a chance to revise it. It's a real treasure. Woodsmucky'll love it. She had time to think, that's pretty inventive. What are you going to do if he takes you up on it? But Jim Dooley wasn't taking her up on anything. He was on his knees in front of her, panting harshly. It was hot up here already. If she'd known she was going to be taking a beating in Scott's study today, she certainly would have turned on the air conditioning first thing, and rummaging in his lunch sack again. There were big sweat rings spreading out from under his arms.
"Missus, I'm sorry as hell to do this, but at least it ain't your pussy," he said.
And she had time to register two things before he swept his left hand down the front of her, tearing open her blouse and popping the catch at the front of her bra so that her small breasts tumbled free. The first was that he wasn't sorry a bit. The second was that the object in his right hand had almost certainly come from her very own things drawer. Scott had called it Lisey's yuppie church key. It was her OXO can opener, the one with the heavy-duty rubber hand grips.